Okay, so this is the second seminar on writing the history of the First World War, introduction to historiography and memory studies. We will be looking at memory studies a bit later. And we're almost at the end of sources, you will be pleased to know. This is not that these are all the possible sources, but these are some of the main sources that have, which have been...
Je peux apprendre à mieux vous comprendre si je me familiarise avec votre façon de parler. Il me faut votre autorisation pour aider.
Allez vous faire avoir. Okay, voilà. I obviously clicked on the wrong thing there. I didn't deliberately do this to amuse you. That's right. Yes, the last one I looked at was monuments, and that somebody had decided that it would be interesting to see what language was used, what vocabulary was used, how the decisions were made, and so on. And it's a good example because it reminds you that my list of sources is not complete, and one day somebody will find a completely new source that nobody thought of studying. That's what making history is about, that historians actually make history. They don't just find it, they actually make it. They make a new question, and that makes it possible to make new history. Now, I never really did that myself, because everybody knew that popular songs existed, but I think for a long time people thought that popular songs have nothing interesting in them. So there you go for the monuments. Some of the recent monuments are very, very interesting, because, strangely enough, a large number of monuments have been placed for the First World War in the last 10 years. A lot of new monuments. New monuments 10 years later. It's a very, very strange idea in a way. Normally you expect a monument 10 years afterwards, maybe 20 years afterwards. But in fact, monuments can have a very long life. I saw a monument in Oxford recently to the dead of the Reformation. It was a monument to Catholics and Protestants from Oxford killed in the Reformation and in the Civil War. We're talking about the 16th and 17th century. The monument is 10 years old. Yeah. So suddenly somebody thought, oh, let's put up. And of course, what's new about it is it's Catholics and Protestants on the same monuments. And in the same way, in the last few years, some of the monuments for the First World War have been joint monuments between the two sides. So we will look at those in a moment. Here is a new monument, just a few years old in Britain. What can you see? Can you describe it to me? It's a what? With a blindfold on. Okay, how old is he? Anybody? He's young. I think he's a boy, really. He's pretty young to me. Why is he wearing a blindfold? Is he playing a fun game? You know, it's Halloween, let's all wear, no. Yeah?
He's about to be executed.
Yeah, he's about to be executed, really, so this is not so good. And that's what this new monument is. It's a monument to the British soldiers executed by the British Army during the First World War. And naturally enough, it's recent, because for a very, very long time, if you were executed for cowardice or for falling asleep on the job, then you didn't get a monument. That was the whole deal. This recent monument, here is the recent monument. This goes along with a longer political debate, because for many, many years in the 1970s, in the 1980s, in the 1990s, the British government was lobbied by some of the families of the executed and say, we want a pardon. Yeah, we would like the government to officially pardon the men who were shot for cowardice in the First World War. So it's a very interesting demand in a way. This is something that, you know, can you imagine your great-great-grandfather was shot for cowardice? And the question is, which, you know, you just think about, how much would you care? You know, some people say, oh, well, you know, it's a matter of honour of the family. And other people are like, he died 100 years ago, you know, let's forget it, you know. So these are complicated questions. And in any case, just a few years ago in Britain, they decided to pardon the entire bunch. In France, there is also the same debate, and so far there has been no pardon. There was a debate in Parliament in France in 2016, last year. Yeah, shall we pardon? And the decision was no. This debate continues, yes, but it all does tell us something about how to remember the past, how to commemorate the past, and there are no really easy answers. I'm sure this is the same in Rouen, but in Paris, over the last 25 years, every school now has a plaque saying, you know, the number of Jewish children who were taken from there by the French government to be killed by the Nazis. So these are new, these are just 20 years old. So long after it has been, the dynamic and the timeline of commemoration is follows different rules. But it seems to begin with the First World War, because I've never heard anybody saying, oh, I wish there was a monument to my great-great-great-grandfather who died in the Napoleonic Wars. Now, the First World War is 100 years ago, and the Napoleonic Wars is 200 years. Yeah, okay, 200 years is much longer than 100 years, but even 100 years is a very long time. And so it seems that the First World War is the war that made it different from the point of view of commemoration. But there are a lot more things to think about in that. Here's a second one. This is a modern monument, just a few years old. In fact, I think it's 2014. And I don't know, what army is he from? You know, what army does he come from? You know, he's from the German army. Do you recognize the helmet? You know, in the films, yeah? This is a German helmet. Yeah, in the films, and also in real life. Okay, and so, and this is an Englishman, and they're just saying, hi. In fact, this is a monument to the Christmas truce, which also you may have heard of, and I will be talking about later, in a number of places along the front line on Christmas Day 2014. French and German, or English and German soldiers, organized a truce. That is, they refused to fight because it's Christmas, and instead they played football and things like that. And there they are. Where is the statue? It's in my flat. This is my flat, actually. No. Where is it?
A church.
Yeah, a church, yeah. And in fact, to be absolutely precise, a cathedral. Yeah. So that's not, that's not obviously important information, too. And here we have another recent, 2014. This is a brand new monument. So there are still new monuments going up. And we'll be looking at some of those when we get to memory studies. But for today, I want to talk about different ways of writing history, and in particular, different ways what people have found to write history of the First World War. And basically, I didn't make this up. It was somebody else who wrote a book called, in French, Pensez la Grande Guerre. And they said there were three fields of history of the First World War. And these are also three fields which apply to history in general. And so we're going to look at them in order. First field, military and diplomatic history. Watch carefully. I think I'll do that again. Firstly, military and diplomatic history. Now, when we say there were three fields, these three fields appeared one after the other. After 1918, these three fields appeared one after the other, but this does not mean that the new one arriving replaced the old one. So basically, you have a period when it's almost all military and diplomatic history, and then you have a period where there is still military and diplomatic history, but also field number two, and then you have a period where there is also field number three, and the latest one to arrive dominates the universities. Yeah, so that's the idea. So, and for the first, certainly 15 or 20 years, historians only really wanted to write military and diplomatic history. If they want to write military and diplomatic history, I remember mentioning last week that one of the most important things is what are the questions. So, can you think of some military and diplomatic history questions about the First World War? What kind of questions are you asking? What kind of questions would you imagine they would ask?
Yeah. How many people were killed during the
Numbers, yeah. How many people were killed in each battle, in each month, and so on. Okay, yeah. So that's a fairly simple question, isn't it? Let's see if we can try and find a question beginning with why. All the most interesting questions in history begin with why. So what kind of questions? Yeah, you got an idea there? Yeah, absolutely. Well, why did the Germans lose, you know? Also, why did they win this battle and lose this battle? Yeah, and so they are questions of military effectiveness, yeah? And one of the reasons to ask them is because the army would like to learn so that they do better next time, you know? What kind of weapons were used? Yeah, how effective was the tank? These are the kind of questions. So they're all about. Now, the questions are very important because if you choose to answer certain questions, that's because these are the questions you think are the most important. And military historians generally, certainly in the 20s, were people who thought the most important question is, you know, how to win a war. And so obviously this is a historian's position, but it's also a political attitude. Yeah? If you say, oh, I think the most important thing about the war is how can we better win it next time, yeah, that's obviously a political thing. And in fact, when you're talking about the First World War, you can't avoid politics. Yeah, because if you have something that lasts four years and many millions of people were killed, that's political. You can't get away from that. You know, it happened for particular reasons, and you can decide, well, it was tragic, but it was worth it, or it was dreadful, and so on. So the very first field is the one of military and diplomatic history, which sets off immediately. The war is over. Very often, the money for this history comes from governments. Governments give money to a historian. Say, here's the money. I want 7 volumes on the battles of the First World War. This is something we need to think about because all history costs money. You know, if you're going to spend five years writing a book, somebody has to pay your rent. Now today, the most common situation is that universities pay the rent of historians. I'll tell you why. If you write history books and you want to make a living, it's almost impossible. I'm very pleased with my book, as you can tell. I'm very proud of my book. So far, I have made €350. From my book. Now, if I give you €350, you're very happy. But if you spend 5 years writing a book and you get €350, you're a bit disappointed. It's extremely difficult to make money writing history books. Not absolutely impossible, a few people do. And so universities pay for people to write history books, mostly. And at the time, it was more governments, sponsored by governments, very often very long ones. This is military and diplomatic history. And if we look at the dictionary for military history, then we get this in the Oxford dictionaries. I always use Oxford dictionaries, of course, because we are British, aren't we? We get the definition of military history in English, the study of the role that armed forces played in past events. And it gives the example, in-depth analyses of 20th century military history. So it's about the armed forces, yeah? Which can include their weapons, their leadership structures. Yeah. How good were the officers? How well organized were the officers in the British Army and the German Army? That's military history. Yeah, there's a lot of it. You've never finished asking questions. And of course, the sources you would be imagining would be military reports, diplomatic letters, telegrams, archives, etc. And the questions asked are strategic questions. How can we win next time? Why did the Germans not get to Paris in the First World War? Those kind of questions. This is also the period when the leaders would tend to write their memoirs. I showed you last week General Joffre, Lloyd George. They're writing, you know, to show the history, to show the world that they were right. Which is fair enough. Interestingly enough, in this period, the experience of the ordinary soldier is not considered to be history. Historians are not writing books about the life of the ordinary soldier in the 1920s and the 1930s. Why not? Well, that's a good question. Good question, why not? Well, firstly, because you have to understand, firstly, at the time, remember, very few people go to university. Historians are mostly from the elites. And the general consensus is that the life of ordinary people is not very interesting. Also, from a military point of view, it's considered to be non-strategic. The individual soldier, what does he know about the battle or about the war strategy? Not much. This is quite extreme because the French historian Pierre Renouvin wrote this book, La crise européenne à la Première Guerre mondiale, which is a very respected book at the time. And when he was in the war, he was severely wounded. I think he lost an arm or something. And he never mentions it in his history book. So that's a very good symbol that it was really considered that individual experience, that's not history. Because our idea of what is history and what is a historical fact has got wider and wider throughout the 20th century. The other side of the same thing here is that the democratic spirit was rare. Remember, in Britain, after 1918, half the women have the vote. Women over 30 have the vote. All men have the vote after 1918. Before 1918, two-thirds of men had the vote. And so the idea of people having the vote is very new. And the elite were not really convinced. They said, oh, well, okay, we better give them the vote because they're very angry. But they weren't really convinced that it was a necessary good thing. Like the democratic spirit was not so developed. I was telling you, I think, last week that if you went to a private school in England, you were automatically an officer. So this is the old way of things, whereas today we would expect there to be some sort of democratic spirit, that everybody has a chance, so on. So what does this mean? This means that in the 20s, in the 30s, the experience of the ordinary soldier might be respected by poets, and so the war poems of Siegfried Sassoon were already popular. He wrote them during the war. They were already popular in the 20s. So the soldiers' experience was good for literature and good for poetry, but they were not considered to be part of history as such. What's that one? Yeah, the war poems of secrets. These are two different editions, just to show that it's continued to be it's been popular for almost a century. And otherwise, Wilfred Owen's poems popular for the whole time, but not part of history. Now, military history continued right to today. Even today, there is a lot of military history being written today, a lot of new military history being written today, and they haven't run out of subjects. However, we do find that in the last 50 years, there has been a change in the way military history is looked at. So, as you can imagine, there is a lot of military history that's been written. You know, Regiment number 1 in the First World War, Regiment number 2 in the First World War, Regiment number 3, Battle number 1, Battle number 2, Battle number 3, Weapon number 1, Weapon number 2, you know, just loads and loads of it. And nevertheless, recently people still find new ideas of military history. For example, this book is just a few years old, Tip and Run, The Untold Tragedy of the Great War in Africa. Because when we learn about the First World War, we always think about France, because there were, you know, I don't know, 700 kilometers of trenches. And we know very little, or most people know very little, about what happened in Africa, where the different colonial countries attacked each other's colonies. And it was very bloody. So one way of writing new military history is to find a new area which has not been sufficiently studied. There's another example there, a specific military operations in Egypt and Palestine from June 1917. And you see this is actually written by military people. and published by the Imperial War Museum. And notice that this is official history of the Great War. Yeah. So you can write military history by choosing a particular area or by choosing a particular weapon. This book is about defeating the U-boats. In the First World War, the Germans were more advanced than the other side in the U-boat, what we call the submarine. Since even in 1914, Britain imported a lot of food, the U-boat, which could stop ships from getting in, was an important weapon in the total war. And this is about how they managed to defeat the U-boat, not just militarily, also organisationally. That they at one point they decide that all the food ships and the supply ships will all move at the same time, so they will only ever move 50 ships at once and never one at once. And this apparently is a very good thing from a military point of view. Tanks in the Great War, 1914 to 1918. The first time the tank was used was in 1916. It was invented, and it was a very, very important invention because there is something very simple about the First World War from a military point of view. In 1914, the best defensive weapon was the machine gun. That's the best defensive weapon. And the best attacking weapon was the soldier walking forward. And you can see the problem. The machine gun is much more effective than the soldier walking forward. And this is why nothing happened for years. This is why, for a long time in France, the army which advanced lost. And they kept trying to find a new way to do it. And the tank, however, changes the situation, because sometimes a tank can advance against the machine gun. Now, of course, meanwhile, the scientists are working hard trying to find a new weapon to stop the tank advancing, but for a little moment, the tank advancing is the best weapon. And what's more, naturally, when they developed the tank in Britain originally, they kept it secret. This is war, yeah? It's good to keep things secret, you know? You don't phone the Germans, hey, guess what we're developing, yeah? And so when the tanks arrived on the battlefield, the Germans were extremely surprised. What is that? There are also a number of songs written about the tank, of course, but popular songs always like to be written about the latest thing, and so there's The Tanks That Broke the Ranks Out in Picardy, the lovely jolly tune about tanks. They never miss a trick. So later military history has to generally try to find something new. Now, a new weapon that hasn't been studied, a new area which hasn't been studied. Sometimes new, sometimes other new things, which we'll come to in a moment. But also, as the democratic spirit moved forward, even historians, even military historians, had to respect the individual soldiers, or pretend, then we find a lot more military history from below. That is military history from the point of view of what happened to the ordinary soldier. What was their experience like? And this, even today, in 2015, this is the kind of history which sells the most copies. Yeah, this is the now. Does anybody here have members of their family who likes to read books about the history books about the war? Yeah, and what kind of books do they like? Do they like books about ordinary soldiers or something else? You don't know, you don't care. Oh, you don't know. Okay. Ask them. Yeah. This is the one that sells, you know. If you just look in your local bookshop in Rouen, if you go to the history section in Armentières, first of all, you will see you have a small history section. Half of it is about wars, which is a strange idea in itself. The First World War has 100 books in Rouen. And half of them are about military history from below. This is the one that sells the most. For example, Richard Holmes wrote this massive book of 500 pages. Tommy, the British soldier on the Western Front, 1914 to 1918. I don't have the exact date in mind. I think it's about 20 years ago he wrote this. And it's very modern, because he looks at every aspect of the ordinary soldier's life. And he doesn't avoid the questions which they avoided at the time. So, for example, there are a few pages about what was life like for homosexual soldiers. How were they treated? Which is obviously a question they didn't ask in the 1920s. It was all shh, shh. And there's about what kind of food did they eat, what kind of wounds did they get, how did they sometimes get wounds deliberately, etc. You know, it's not trying to hide things. So this is not official history trying to justify one side or the other. It's about experience. And this is a trend which will be rising when we get to the... for example, in the Imperial War Museum in London, there are obviously a big section dedicated to the First World War. Interestingly enough, the Imperial War Museum, it sounds very conservative and old-fashioned, doesn't it? Imperial War Museum. And in fact, it's a very modern avant-garde museum. For example, they did a big exhibition on pacifism in Britain and the peace movement in Britain a few years ago. In any case, they completely changed their First World War galleries for the centenary, and the new one is completely centred about people's experience. The old one was more about, you know, who was winning, who was losing. The new one is absolutely about experience. In fact, even perhaps one might think it's gone a little bit far, and it's full of, you know, here's a helmet, put it on your head, what does it feel like, you know, etc. It's sort of really hands-on, which very, very British museography. The British like to do that, you know. If you go to a museum in Britain and there's no clothes to put on, you're disappointed, yeah. You don't get to do that. So, in any case, the value of experience, trying to get close to the experience of the people 100 years ago, is more and more important in society's view of history. Now, it's a difficult one, because is it possible, is it really possible for us to understand how they felt 100 years ago? You know how difficult it is to understand your parents? Yeah. So, and they're not even 100 years old, most of them. Okay, right, there's one example. There's another one then, some mud. Okay, so very clearly there, some mud, the experiences of an infantryman in France. This is, in fact, the story about just one soldier. And so we're getting along to memoirs and so on. This is not a memoir, it's a history book. Unknown soldiers. This was a new approach, because, as you can see, it's a history of the missing of the First World War. Les portés disparus. So how many were really prisoners, how many were dead and never found, etc. So he found something new about them. You always have to find some new question to write a history book. And possibly the best one is this one, although I have to admit that the title is not very exciting, Trench Warfare. Well, you know, La Guerre des Tranchées, bon d'accord. And what Tony Ashworth did in this one, which is quite a while ago, he asked a new question. The new question was, what happens in the trenches when there is not a battle? There had been many, many books, history books about the battles, the Battle of Passchendaele, the Battle of Verdun, the Battle of the Somme, and so on. He said, well, there are 800 kilometres of trenches and 4 years. Most of the time, there was not a battle. Yeah. It was very, very typical to have a battle for a month, and then no battle for 12 months. And this is quite an important perspective. It means that you're looking at the world from the point of view of the soldier experiencing it. First of all, being bored was a very, very major enemy. You get extremely bored. Secondly, they worked very hard not to be bored. An incredible number, I know about the British Army, I'm sure it's similar elsewhere, an incredible number of football games, horse races, football tournaments, you know, whether you get a football team in each division, an incredible number of amateur musical performances, shows and pantomimes and just all the time these things going on. But this is military history, so he was looking at what happened in the trenches. What he discovered was the live and let live system. So what he calls the live and let live system, which is basically how can you avoid the war even though you're in the trenches? Well, you can't avoid the war, but maybe you could avoid fighting. Just for today, and that's one day more, you know, you're just trying to survive. So, for example, let me give you a few examples. You could talk to the Germans opposite and you say, listen, every morning at 11 o'clock, we will bomb on the left-hand side, and every afternoon at 3 o'clock, you bomb at the right-hand side. This means when the big general comes, we can say, oh yes, look at all the bombing we've been doing. But in fact, nobody will get killed. Not unusual, very intelligent ways of how to not fight. Because when we think about the war, we occasionally imagine, and it's wrong, we occasionally imagine that the soldiers are thinking in the same way as the generals. That the soldiers are, how can we win? How can we win? How can we win? But they're not necessarily, they would prefer to win than to lose. Remember, most of the soldiers are not very political. So, you know, they'd rather win than lose, but, you know, they might rather lose than continue. And so, learning to work. There are other ways of doing this as well. For example, one of the best ways from a military point of view to make progress is the night patrol. If you send 10 men out in the middle of the night, secretly, they can often surprise the enemy and cause quite a bit of damage with only 10 men. So, from a military point of view, it's a good tactic. And so the British hierarchy encouraged more and more of this, and they wanted a list. They wanted a bureau. At the beginning of the war, they could control locally. You decide when you do night patrols. But towards the end of the war, they said, no, this is not right. You must do three night patrols every night in your area, you see. And the hierarchy didn't trust the soldiers and said, and you must bring back every time, you must bring back a bit of German barbed wire and put it barbelé allemand. And so, of course, what the soldiers did is they stole a big ball of barbed wire, and every day they cut a little bit off to give to the hierarchy. You also need to remember, first of all, soldiers are, you know, intelligent people, but secondly, they had nothing to do all day but to think about the best ways to avoid. There are much more violent ways of avoiding war. Deliberately getting wounded is one of them. And a very large number of wounds were in the hands, because you sort of wave your arm around and hope somebody shoots you. Yeah, and a lot of people got wounded like that. You have to be careful, of course. You don't want anybody to see you. Interestingly enough, we know very little about how people surrendered, because of course one way of surviving the war is to choose the right moment and to surrender. Then you're a prisoner. And, you know, prisoner can be safer. We know very little about that. Partly because, of course, people who surrendered did not write memoirs afterwards, because it was kind of keep it secret. We know very little about that. But in any case, to get back to this book, a wonderful series of things, simple things like, you know, no shooting before 10 o'clock in the morning, so everybody has time to get breakfast. Lots of things like that were going on. One of the very powerful military history books, but mainly because he found a new question, and his new question was, what happened when there isn't a battle? And finding a new question, it can take a long time to find a new question, but if you've got one, it's fabulous stuff. I don't know where. One of them missed. One of them missing. In any case, another very original book, this time by a woman, which I don't have a picture of, is by Ilana Bet-El. And she wrote a book called Conscripts. Les Conscrits. And this is because many, many history books have been written about the British volunteers. The British Army had three separate groups. First of all, the army, the professional army, who were already in the army in 1914, professional soldiers. Secondly, the volunteers, who volunteered to join in 1914, 15 and 16. For the duration of the war, they signed a contract, I am a soldier until the war ends. So very different from professional soldiers, the citizens' armies. And thirdly, after 1916, the conscripts, yeah, where they came and knocked on your door and said, okay, it's your turn, you're now in the army. And many of the history books had written a lot about the volunteers, because it was very glorious being a volunteer, and not so much about the conscripts. And so Ilana Bettel, in her book, she tried to look at the experience of the conscripts and questions like, did they think of themselves as soldiers? Or did they think of themselves as civilians in arms, or obliged to be in the army, and so on? Because in fact, the conscripts were the majority of British soldiers in the First World War. I think it's not a big majority. I think 52% or something like that of British soldiers in the First World War were conscripts, were obliged to be there by the law. Because, in fact, the volunteer campaign petered out after 1915. People were not so keen on the idea. Most people in Britain, the vast majority of people in Britain, wanted Britain to win the war. But if Britain can win the war without me joining the army, that's even better. Yeah, because people are very human like this. There's another example. Richard van der Emden wrote a book about prisoners of war. Again, prisoners of war is something we don't know a lot about, because when the prisoners of war came back, they were often very ashamed of being prisoners. They had stopped fighting. Sometimes they had surrendered. And so it's been much more difficult to get that information. This military history from below, of course, also includes diaries. And here we have diaries or memoirs. Now, the difference is that a diary is written at the same time and a memoir is written later. But sometimes you see that they actually write memoirs. In fact, it's a diary. So here we have a machine gunner, the memoirs of a machine gunner on the Western Front. Very, very interesting book. And the machine gunners, because they didn't have a lot of machine... Well, they didn't like to leave the machine guns in the same place. Because if you leave the machine gun in the same place for all day, then the enemy was like, oh, there's the machine gun. We need to bomb that place there. And machine guns are very expensive. So what they did is the machine gun would arrive, work for 2 hours, and then move. And go 3 kilometers further up or something. The result is that the machine gunners were not very popular. Because they arrived, you know, you're sitting in a trench having a rest. I'm a machine gunner, I arrived. I'm just going to shoot the Germans for 3 hours, and then I'm going away. So, but what about the retaliation? You will get the retaliation, yeah? So, in fact, very often they would arrive, and the soldiers would be insulting them, because they were making life more dangerous for them. That's one particular experience which worth having. This, the diary of a great war soldier, and so it's a diary, so it's written at the time, a great war soldier and artists, that he would sit in the trenches making little drawings, and so that's been published too. And this one here, my diary of the great war, Stephen Curtis McBride, I think he's an officer. And I already mentioned to you that for a long while we had mostly diaries from officers, because officers are middle-class people who are good at writing, and the soldiers were working-class people who they could write, but, you know, they didn't write very much. But that's no longer the case. Today we have quite a few diaries of ordinary soldiers, because, of course, the other thing is there were far more ordinary soldiers altogether. And the last one, very interesting one here, is the Great War Diaries of Chaplain Kenneth Best. So a chaplain is a priest, yeah? Priest? Well, an Anglican priest. The British Army had officially recruited religious men to be chaplains to look after the military, the spiritual needs of the soldiers. They employed Anglican chaplains, Catholic chaplains, and Jewish chaplains. Mostly Anglicans, of course, but they also occurred the others. This could be quite complicated. Did I tell you about Catholic priests last week? No, let me tell you something about Catholic priests. The Anglican priests were not very popular among the soldiers, and the Catholic priests were rather popular. Now, I'm not just saying this because I'm a Catholic and I think we're better. It's actually for a reason. And one of the reasons is that, first of all, there was a social difference. The Anglican Church is the official church in England. And so the people who became vicars tended to be from the elites. In fact, at one point it was kind of a tradition. If you're a rich family, your eldest son went into parliament, and the second one went into the church, and the third one into the army. You know, it was a rigid thing like that. And so let's say that the Catholic priests were more working class. They could talk more easily the language of the ordinary soldiers. But also there was a theological difference. And that is that if people are dying... in the Catholic religion, then it's very important to give them the last rites, the final sacraments. So basically, the Catholic priests are obliged to be on the battlefield where people are dying, because it's extremely important religiously that they get the communion and the last rites at the last moment. Yeah. Well, this doesn't exist in Anglican religion, and so the Anglican priests tended to be somewhere further away. The Anglican Church was very worried about this, and they changed some of their rules. That the First World War actually changed the religion in a couple of ways. And one way is that traditionally in the Anglican Church, when you consecrate the bread on a Sunday, the bread must be eaten immediately. The vicar is not allowed to carry some consecrated bread around for all week. Whereas in the Catholic Church, that's okay. You can do that. So this is an accident, the difference. But in the battlefield, this was very important. At the beginning of the war, it was impossible for Anglican priests to give communion because they couldn't carry consecrated bread. And so they changed this rule. The Church of England said, okay, we're changing this rule. Now you may carry consecrated bread. Now, this sounds like a detail, but as you know, when churches change their rules... They take a long time about it, you know, 20 years usually, to change the rules. And the second thing which changed is that in the Anglican Church, before the First World War, it was not recommended to pray for the dead. Praying for the dead is not a Protestant thing. The Anglican idea was, it's God's problem, God must decide, and it's arrogant for us to say, hey God, remember Michael. You know, we shouldn't do that. But in the First World War, the demand for praying for the dead was massive. That's what people wanted to do. People wanted to pray for the dead because it was so... And the Anglican Church, they just changed their rules and introduced praying for the dead. Yeah, so this is one of the reasons that we sometimes talk about the First World War as the deluge. Yeah. Le deluge, something which really changed the whole society, which got shaken up at the time. And with a bit of luck, you're getting the impression that First World War history is a little bit more varied than you thought it might be. I have here an extract from one of the diaries from Mr. Lynch. It's a little bit gory, but it just shows some of them that they come up with. Just outside the wood, we came to a well-constructed trench. In it, there's a British soldier to every yard, killed on the parapet in trying to hop off. 20 yards in front, a row of dead British soldiers in perfect line as if on parade, NCOs in position, and a half dozen paces ahead, their platoon officer, a rusty revolver in one outstretched hand, his whistle still clasped in the other, mowed down by machine guns. We see two men, a Fritz and a Tommy, dead within a yard of each other. The Fritz has a British bayonet through his throat, while the Tommy lies doubled over a Fritz bayonet whose point protrudes from his back. So, you know, just in case, you know, of course, if you come to a class on the First World War, you expect a little bit of blood and gore, so there's a little bit of blood and gore for you, but I won't be giving you too many bits. Now, we're still with military history, and as well as finding a new area to study, a new regiment to study, a new weapon to study, there's another element which allowed a whole load of new books to be written, and this is to write about particular groups. Here is an example. It's Richard van Emden as well. Boy soldiers of the Great War. At the beginning of the war, I think you were supposed to be 17 to join the army and 19 to go and fight abroad. Many, many younger boys tried to join. And I think the youngest killed in the British Army was 13. Was 13 years old. Now, how was this possible? Well, first of all, I'm sure you understand, the recruiting officer didn't care. In fact, it was very typical where they'd say, you know, how old are you? Oh, I'm 15. Well, go and walk away and come back when you're 17. And so he came back 5 minutes later. How old are you? 17. And they signed him up. You know, they really didn't care. But also, interestingly enough, even public opinion was not necessarily that much against it. You need to, I mean, of course, when you think a 13-year-old joined the army, we're very shocked. Now, of course, I hope you're shocked. Do you have little brothers you would like to have them join the army at 13? No, okay, good. But you have to remember what the alternative was. You're talking about big families. One of our children died at 8 years old. The other one, well, he's working down the mines, he's 11. You see what I mean? It wasn't quite so shocking when the life of 13-year-olds was already, you know, could be extremely hard. They could be down the mines or working in the mines and so on. So it was a little less shocking. But this is also special from another point of view. And that is, look at the stop, their own stories. This is, in fact, oral history. What he did it in the 1970s or the 1980s, I think. And he went to find... Because, of course, because they joined the army when they were very young, if they were not killed, they would still be alive. Some of them would still be alive in the 1980s. They were 85, and he interviewed the soldiers about them. Fabulous book, Oral History. I will come back to oral history, which is a complex idea, in fact, more complicated than it sounds. Because when you ask 85-year-old people what their life was like when they were 13... They have forgotten a lot of things, and they may be inventing things. You know, when you're 85, you don't care. You know, make it up, you know. So it can be a little complicated, but very, very interesting. But, and you can see that they look like absolute little kids, you know, absolute little kids. So it is pretty, pretty shocking in a way. So this was Boy Soldiers of the Great War. Richard Van Emden is one of the exceptions. This is a man who makes a living writing history books about the First World War. Now, if you want to make a living writing history books, the First World War is a fairly good choice. In history books, it sells better than other periods. You know, if you're very, very interested in the 13th century, you're just never going to make any money from it. Having said that, I have not yet succeeded in making any serious money from the First World War, but I live in hope. Okay, boys, soldiers. Second one. Here's the one I already mentioned to you. Today's military history is one of the ways of widening it out and allowing yourself to write more books is to choose particular groups. And I already explained this to you. This is Ilana Bet-El writing about conscripts. And one of the exceptions, I'm sure you're not surprised to hear that most military historians are men. But it's changing, and here you have one of the leading women military historians. Another particular group within the military, in this case the conscientious objectors. These are people who refused to join the army or refused to fight because they said it's against my moral code. Now, there are a number of interesting things about this. First of all, in many countries, this did not exist. In France, you couldn't say, in the First World War, in France, you couldn't say, je suis objecteur de conscience, je veux pas y aller. You were just thrown in jail because you were a deserter. So Britain was exceptional in having the existence of the status of a conscientious objector. It was quite difficult to get this status, but it did exist. Which brings us to the interesting question, why in Britain did the conscientious objector status exist? And this, I'm coming back to what I said before, all the most interesting questions in history begin with why. I don't think you will guess. So I'm going to just give you the answer. I won't ask. Would anybody like to guess why this status of conscientious objector exists in Britain? Well, it's about religion. You see, in France is a Catholic country, although it's not an official religion. At the First World War, Everybody was Catholic. There were a few Protestants, but it wasn't a deal. But Britain is a Protestant country and always has had to deal with religious variety. Because Protestants are not like Catholics. Catholics, we're all Catholics. We say, the Pope says go, we go. Protestants, oh well, you've got the Anglicans and the Methodists and the Baptists and the United Reformed Church and the dissenters. You've got a whole load of different varieties of Protestantism. There is a tradition in Britain of allowing for religious diversity, which goes back 200 years, that this is what made it possible to stabilise the political system in Britain after the Civil War in the 17th century, was an acceptation of religious diversity. In the 20th century, this has turned out to be an advantage, for example, for Muslim immigrants to Britain, because there is a history of, oh yeah, you do things differently, your religion, that's fine, we have six already, you know. But that's an accident. And so the result is that it was understood that some religions, like the Quakers, for example, strictly forbade any military action, any violence. They were totally pacifist religions. And so it was possible, and there were three or four members of parliament who were Quakers, and they persuaded the minister, the war minister, to accept that there could be a status of conscientious objection. Now, it was difficult to get. You had to go in front of a tribunal and prove it. And basically, the only real excuse they would accept is if you could show you were a member of a pacifist religion. Yeah. If you didn't want to join the army because you were a communist, that was not so convincing. Yeah, they weren't so happy with that. Or, as they would say at the time, a socialist. So the religious pacifists were often accepted as conscientious objectors. But other people were conscientious objectors who were not accepted but just refused to go. And many things happened to them. At the beginning, there was a group of conscientious objectors who said, you know, we refuse. And they just said, you know, you're in the army. They took them to France and they said, you know, if you don't obey orders, we will execute you. So they were scared. And they were fortunate because there was a political campaign in Britain and pressure was put on the government. And they were not executed. They were brought back to Britain and put in prison. Yeah. And many of the conscientious objectors passed the war in prison. There are different sorts of conscientious objectors. Some people said, okay, I will work as a lorry driver or an ambulance driver. Yeah, I will work in France with the army, but I will not shoot. Whereas other people said, no, I'm not going to France at all because I don't want to participate in the war. And even some of them said, I will not work on a farm in Britain because if I work on a farm in Britain, I'm leaving, I'm liberating a man to go to war. Okay, so there was a lot of debates about that. So interesting history book there. This is one which is similar to the diary I showed you a little while ago, but in this case it is a history book about padres, so the priests, the religious priests. Religious officials were treated differently in Britain than in France. In France, the priest was the same as everybody else. It's the 4th of August. You're in the army now. Oh, you're a priest. I don't care. You're in the army. There was no difference in France. Whereas in Britain, if you were a priest, you were not conscripted. You could volunteer for religious duties. So basically, you could tell the difference between a British priest and a French priest. The British priest did not have a gun. They didn't, unless they had decided that they wanted to join the commandant units. We're going to take a 5-minute break. You have time for one cigarette.